You're listening to The Word from Westwood, a series of podcasts featuring sermons preached at Westwood United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California.
There is a lot of stuff I wish I knew up front when this parenting journey began. Linda and I had read plenty of books. We'd had lots of advice. And like most of you here, learned a certain amount by trial and error, right? We also held on to that delusion of young parents that there would come a time when the task was over. Well, it's never over, is it? You know what I'm talking about. It seems that parenthood flips the worrying switch on, and it stays frozen in that on position forever, right? As our kids get older, and while there may not be as much dependence upon us as the parent, the worries are still there, and they are often much more complex. Sometimes we long for that day when the problem could be fixed with a Band-Aid and a warm embrace. You know what I'm talking about. Well, I guess that is just one of the realities of what it means to be in close relationship with another person. Whether it is as a kid, a parent, a sibling, a friend, we have this propensity to worry. In my case, with an Italian grandmother and an Italian mother, worrying was a way of life. It was guaranteed, and I must say it really has been passed very nicely on to the next generations. You know, we have this desire to want to fix things. We want to help those that we care about and love so that they can avoid the pitfalls and the valleys that we come to learn are a guaranteed part of life. Sometimes those worries are short-term. Sometimes those worries fill a lifetime. One of the unfortunate things is that the worries can bog you and me down in such a way that we miss living our own lives and we forget to participate in what are the most life-giving activities. Now, there is a collective wisdom that we have inherited when it comes to worry. Perhaps you might be thinking right now of Jesus' instruction not to worry, that it was a waste of time. Some of you in the back of your mind right now might even be hearing the voice of Bobby McFerrin singing and whistling, "Don't worry, be happy." I'm sorry about planting that earworm. I know I'm going to hear it the rest of the day now. But friends, we still worry. We come by it honestly. Our biblical record is absolutely full of people worrying, and they had a lot to worry about. Life was unpredictable at best. And worry is one of the ways that people in ancient times, as well as us in modern times, deal with uncertainty. The children of Israel, for example, complained and worried incessantly during their desert wanderings, much to Moses' dismay, even though God had promised that God would be in their midst. And then, friends, if we look in our New Testament to the many letters that are part of it, this particular letter to the Philippians, which we've been studying, quite a few are a testament to Paul being that perpetual worry wart. Paul worried incessantly about what was going on in the fledgling churches that he had helped start. He worried if the people were actually being faithful to God's claim on their lives. He worried about the way that the people in these churches were treating one another. He worried about where their loyalties were being placed, who really was their God. He was worried that about these new places, these new church starts, wondering if they would keep focused on the goal. And he was worried if they were even going to last. Now, in the case of the church in Philippi, he concluded his letter with these familiar words we've been thinking about the last several weeks. We've sung today in a variety of ways, "Rejoice, rejoice in the Lord always." And just in case the Philippians didn't get it, he wrote it again. He said it with a second very specific command, "Rejoice and do not worry." Yeah, right. That's really easy to say, don't you think? And you, if you're like me at all, you almost want to roll your eyes every time you read something like this from Paul. And it makes you wonder what Paul was thinking. Was he naive? Was he just being cavalier? Did he think if you said something enough, you might actually believe it? Well, as we've considered before, it's really important for us, so far removed from Paul and the people of his time, to remember this one driving ideal that was very present in these first communities of people who were following Jesus. See, we can't ever forget that there was this tightly held belief and this expectation that Jesus was going to return to them at any moment. And as best we can tell today, this was not some philosophical, symbolic, metaphorical thing. It was an actual belief that he was going to return and that God would issue a new world order in their time. And it was this belief that undergirded all of Paul's thought and all of his instruction to the early church. And when the texts which make up our New Testament were completed, this was still a prevailing thought which had outlived Paul. Well, as you can imagine, Christianity has had to deal with this mistaken notion ever since. It is impossible to even begin to understand Paul and many of the New Testament writers without using this filter that they had in front of them, that Jesus was going to return at any moment. That notion was responsible for so many of the emphatic statements regarding life in the community, whether a person, for example, should marry or not, and all the statements about what it meant to be involved in righteous living. In other words, Paul really believed the time was short when it came to getting life in order and being ready for the return of Jesus into the world. And given this kind of outlook and worldview, it really is no surprise then that Paul would say, "Rejoice in the Lord always." It was the way to say, keep up the faith. You only have to do it for a little while because things are going to change and they are going to change soon. Well, after he made that point clear to the Philippians, he reminded them, keep focused. Keep focused on those things that are honorable, on those things that are just, the things that are pure, the things that are pleasing, the things that are commendable. And it would really be kind of hard to argue any of that away, right? These are terrific aspirations for the ancient Philippians and certainly would be ideals to which you and I would like to subscribe to even to this day. The challenge, of course, is how to interpret this teaching of rejoice in the Lord always for our time and our place. Yes, we can look toward these particular ideals and remember what Paul had to say, but rejoice in everything. Can we really rejoice? It is difficult to rejoice, friends. It is difficult to rejoice when we live in a time that for many of us seems more insecure, more volatile, more mean-spirited, and more unpredictable than any time that any of us can remember. How can we rejoice when once again we're starting to talk about the specter of a nuclear holocaust? How can we rejoice when we actively as a nation turn our back on stewardship of the environment, a responsibility, friends, that goes all the way back to our very beginnings in Genesis and does not in any shape or form give us the right to rape the creation around us and to render our world desolate? How can we rejoice when the leaders in our government do not care about the health or welfare of the people or dare to think that the plight of the poor is not our responsibility? How can we rejoice when we lift up religious principles as our backbone, yet do nothing about the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots? How can we rejoice when some of the loudest or most reported voices in Christianity have become the poster children for intolerance and who conveniently forget Jesus' teaching to love neighbor as self? When will we stop? When will we stop giving ourselves permission to redefine what it means to focus on the honorable, that which is just, that which is pure, that which is pleasing and commendable in God's sight, instead twisting and contorting these ideals to support some pure, wrong-headed, and at times dangerous, dare we even say evil and sinful practices? When will the reasons, the voices of reason and hope and possibility and justice drown out the fear-mongers and the opportunists and the self-centered? In other words, how can we not be worried when we see all that is transpiring around us? And then we have these words of Paul. We have these words staring us right in the face, reminding us to rejoice. How do we make any sense of this? Well, maybe it means that we need to start, or perhaps go back to focusing ourselves where it all begins, this relationship that we claim with God. We're told to rejoice in the Lord. Well, what that might mean operatively for us who are struggling with this in this place, in this time in which we're living, could it be, friends, that in the midst of our anger and our frustration, we forget that God is actually at work? And when we refocus on the reality of our lives, we might become better equipped to make a difference in our world when we remember that God is with us. Might it remind us that apart from God, we accomplish much less? In other words, friends, perhaps our rejoicing is in the fact that we are not alone. We know that the Holy Spirit is alive and at work in our world. We know that the power of God's love being in our midst is more powerful than that of any buffoon, any tyrant, and any tunnel-visioned government. We can rejoice. Perhaps the real truth for us that underlies this text is that when we rejoice in God, we cannot help but be changed. God changing us. Imagine that. What a concept. When we rejoice, we're giving thanks for the God that is indwelling within us. We give thanks that God provides for us the compass for how to live a good, wonderful, fulfilled life that properly balances the needs of others with our own. When we rejoice in God, we acknowledge that these wonderful, intangible ideals of which Paul speaks are not impossibilities. But yes, there is a but, and there's always a but when you're preaching, right? But if any of this is to be realized, it requires action on our part. That's the rub, as we say. God does not give us permission to be the passive, apathetic bystander to what we see around us. God certainly does not give the church a buy when it comes to speaking loudly for justice and for hope. Paul dearly loved the church at Philippi and wanted that group of followers of Jesus to be a beacon. And friends, we're inheritors of that. We are inheritors of that same hope and love for which Paul speaks. God gives us grace. God provides for us forgiveness and love, and at the same time calls each of us to be the hope for this time and for this place in which we live. So maybe, just maybe, we need to start feeling some discomfort. Maybe it is now time for us to rejoice. And in that rejoicing, listen. Listen for how each of us can be the counter to the pessimism and fear that is so prevalent in our world. What do you think? What is God asking us to do? Amen.
Westwood United Methodist Church is located at 10497 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, between Westwood Village and Beverly Hills. Sundays are at the heart of this faith community's life, and we invite you to worship every Sunday at 10 a.m. A wide variety of opportunities for all ages are also available every week. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.westwoodumc.org or call the church office at area code 310-474-4511. I'm Janet Hoskins. Westwood United Methodist Church. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God.